I'd like to read, first of all, please, from the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 2 and verse 10. Exodus chapter 2, please, and verse 10. The child Moses grew, and she, his mother, brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses, and she said, Because I drew him out of the water. Came to pass in those days when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren, and looked on their burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew, one of his brethren. And then the epistle to the Hebrews, please. The letter to the Hebrews, and we read, first of all, from chapter 10. Letter to the Hebrews, chapter 10. And we'll read from verse 32. But call to remembrance the former days, in which, after ye were enlightened, ye endured a great fight of afflictions, partly whilst you were made a gazing stock, both by reproaches and afflictions, and partly whilst you became companions of them that were so used. For you had compassion on those in bonds, and took joyfully the spoiling of your goods, knowing in yourselves that ye have in heaven a better and an enduring substance. Cast not away therefore your confidence, which hath great recompense of reward. For ye have need of endurance, that after ye have done the will of God, ye might receive the promise. Beginning of chapter 12, please. Verse 1. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children, My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? And then back into chapter 11, please, and verse 24. Hebrews 11, verse 24, and it's this that we want to study this afternoon. By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. That's all we purpose reading from our Bibles this afternoon. Well, we've been hearing from our brother Mr. Mackenzie about one man who was going to turn his back on a palace to throw in his lot with his brethren, and I was intrigued to pick up from Nehemiah chapter 1 verse 3 the words of Hanani, "The remnant that are left are in great affliction and reproach." Well, we're going to read and study concerning some others who were in great affliction and reproach, and another man who walked out of a palace and turned his back on quite a significant position there to throw in his lot with them. But before we consider Moses, I want us just to spend a moment or two getting our bearings. We're going to, this afternoon, discover why Moses appears so prominently on the page of Hebrews 11. But we're aware at the outset that Hebrews 11 represents a catalogue of men and women of faith, a great listing of men and women whose lives bore witness and testimony to the power and effectiveness of faith. It was the kind of faith which the Hebrew readers of this letter needed if they were to endure. You might have spotted from my selected reading in chapter 10 and the beginning of chapter 12 that the key word of this section of the letter is the word endure or endurance. We picked the word up, if you'd been counting, 6 times. Back in chapter 10 and verse 32, the writer had invited his people to call to remembrance the former days in which, having been enlightened, and the authorized gives the wrong impression here, that it was something that took place sometime after that, but in fact it wasn't, that they were to call to remembrance the former days in which, having been enlightened, they had already endured a great fight of afflictions. In verse 36, he will tell them that you have need of endurance, not patience. You have need of endurance, that having done the will of God, you might receive that which has been promised. Chapter 12 begins by turning our attention to the supreme example of faith, the one who carried faith through to its loftiest triumph, namely the Lord Jesus himself, the author and finisher of faith. But it is in the context of the Christian who is running a race. In chapter 6, the writer talked about the hope that is set before us. But in chapter 12, it is a race that is set before us, and which we are exhorted to run with endurance. And then the Lord Jesus is presented as the example, as one who himself endured. Not a race, but a cross. I know the Authorized Bible says he endured the cross. That's not what the writer said. He endured a cross, despising the shame, all the humiliation and disgrace associated with it. He endured. Consider him, he continues in verse 3, who endured such contradiction, such hostility of sinners against himself. And in verse 7, he talks about us enduring as discipline, as chastisement. And the whole context of this part of the letter is on the subject of endurance. The readers of the letter needed that exhortation to endure, and they needed the kind of faith which men in chapter 11 exemplify. They'd started well enough. We've already learnt that from chapter 10. They were exhorted, as we said, to remember how that from the very beginning they had been marked by a great fight of afflictions. Their early Christian lives had been marked by great enthusiasm. They'd got off to a flying start. And this had been demonstrated in two different areas. It had been demonstrated, first of all, in what they had experienced personally. On the one hand, he says, or as the Authorized puts it, partly, verse 33, partly they had been made a gazing stock. It's the word from which we get our English word theatre. They had been made a public spectacle. And that by way, and you must remember this to understand what we're saying this afternoon, and that by way of affliction and reproach. You were made a gazing stock, both by reproaches and afflictions. I want you just to file that away. They had suffered. They had suffered in name. They had been made a reproach. They had suffered in body. They had physically been abused. They had been afflicted. So on the one hand, there is that which they suffer personally. And in that, they have no choice. They were made a gazing stock. They were made a public spectacle. But on the other hand, there was that which they chose. They became something. They became, as he says at the end of verse 33, companions of them that were so used. That is, they had deliberately chosen to align themselves with and to cast in their lot with those that were going through similar experiences. They had become companions. It's the same word that you pick up twice in Luke chapter 5. You remember when Jesus, on the shore, the crowd pressed on him to hear the word of God, and he commandeers Simon Peter's boat, and he preaches from that, and when he's finished his message, he tells Peter to cast his net and to take up a great catch of fish. And Peter objects initially that we toiled all night and caught nothing. But nevertheless, at thy word, and down goes the net. And then he beckons to their partners in the other boat, James and John. And later on, we're told that they were astonished. Peter is at his knees confessing, I'm a sinful man, O Lord, depart from me. And they were astonished. And so too, Luke says, were their partners. Now that word we there pick up, partner, from Luke 5, is the word companion here. These men had deliberately, the Hebrew Christians, had deliberately stood alongside those that were going through similar experiences. The writer in verse 34 goes back over this ground and amplifies it and expands it a little as he remembers and invites them to remember what they had previously gone through. You had compassion on those in bonds. They had associated themselves deliberately with those that were suffering. It's the word that we get our English word sympathize from. They had, if you like, if I translate it literally, they had suffered along with those in bonds. It was that experience, I suppose, which encouraged the writer in chapter 13 to share with them the knowledge, verse 23, that our brother Timothy is set at liberty. He knew that he could count on these people to be concerned about those in bonds. They would have been ever so excited to discover that Timothy had obtained his release. They were therefore partners with those who were so used, and they had shown sympathy for those in bonds. But at the beginning of verse 33, we had been considering what they had experienced themselves, and he comes back to that at the end of verse 34. They had suffered the looting, the spoiling, the plundering of their goods. They had their earthly possessions stripped from them. And their response, far from being bitterness, they hadn't just gritted their teeth and showed some resignation and just got on with it. They had, he says, welcomed and welcomed with joy the spoiling of their goods. Now that takes some probing. We need to ask ourselves what it was that accounted for that. And the writer knew. He had talked in chapter 6 of Christian hope that functions as an anchor for the soul, sure and steadfast. What is it in the context of this letter when you are tempted to drift away from your moorings? I'm back in chapter 2. What is it that keeps you? Well, he says it is Christian hope. It functions as an anchor. And that's what they found in chapter 10 and verse 34. When they had suffered the plundering of their goods, they knew, they were conscious in themselves that they had something that was better. One of the 13 references to the word in the epistle. Easy to remember that. There are that many chapters. But the thing they had that was better was also lasting. It was that which remained, which is what the word translated in the Authorized Version enduring means in verse 34. It's different to the word that we've been referring to. But they knew in themselves that they had another set of possessions. What's important to notice in verse 34, which is obscured by many translations, is that you have two sets of possessions. The word that the Authorized translates goods and then translates substance is the same. They had welcomed with joy the spoiling of their possessions because they knew in themselves that they had better and more lasting possessions, that there was another world. All this desperately important for our study this afternoon. Since those early days, those initial years of Christian experience, they have gone on in some senses very well. In chapter 6, he will bear them this testimony that God is not unrighteous to forget your work and the love that you've shown to his name in that you've ministered to the saints, and you do minister. They were continuing in their Christian service. There were, however, problems. In chapter 5, he has to say that they have become dull of hearing. That though now they ought to have been teachers, they were in fact really at the stage of having again to go through the very ABC of the oracles of God. But by and large, they have gone on. The problem is that the pressure that they experienced at the beginning has not let up. And that fierce, severe, intense persecution, which marked the very infancy of their Christian experience, has gone on. And in chapter 12, as we were reading, verse 4, you have not yet resisted unto blood, striving, struggling, fighting against sin. Now in chapter 10 we read, you endured a great fight of afflictions. That word fight is what you're really picking up in chapter 12. That's how they started, with this agonizing struggle. The exertion of the Greek athlete in the games sort of idea. And they were contesting at the beginning with afflictions. And that has not changed. And what he is saying in chapter 12 is that they suffered just about everything you can suffer short of actual martyrdom. You have not yet resisted unto blood. And there was a certain ominous ring about that. It carried the implication that it was only a matter of time before they would. And you have been fighting against sin, which I suppose in the context was the sin of apostasy and renouncing everything and going back. So you have a continued, protracted wave of persecution that these men and women had been facing. And they were now in danger of losing heart. And the pressing need of the hour was to bear up, to endure, or in the language of chapter 6, to go on. Let us go on. And really, the letter is that exhortation, this sort of brief exhortation from this writer to go on and keep in there and not give in, to endure. But how are you going to encourage people in that very difficult situation to endure? It's at that point that you introduce this catalogue of people who showed faith, who exemplified faith in a whole range of ways and exploits that they did for God. These people have taken the spoiling of their goods, and yet the man in chapter 13 will exhort them to be content. You must remember when you quote Hebrews 13, but let your conversation, your manner of life be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have. For as much as he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you, so we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, not be afraid of what man can do to me. You must remember when you quote that, that that was written to people who had very little. They had suffered the spoiling of their goods, yet he will tell them to be content. And what is more, in verse 13, he actually has the cheek to suggest that they share what little they've got left with those who are worse off than they are, to do good and to communicate, forget not, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased. These people have found it hard, and I don't suppose it was made easier by the fact that their unbelieving fellow countrymen were having a relatively easy time of it. Prosperity, plenty, peace. And these unbelieving countrymen would have savaged them, would have denied them the very title and name that they had treasured from their infancy, to be called the son of Abraham. And even titles like that now, their unbelieving countrymen would deny them and have them disown. These Hebrew Christians had thrown in their lot with the little flock, with that company of Nazarenes, those of the way, what we label Christians, who were suffering reproach and affliction. Now that's the way they've gone. And they must have been feeling very keenly the temptation now to go back. Hebrews chapter 11 gives us a list of many men and women of faith. But Hebrews chapter 11 is dominated by two men. The center of the stage is occupied by just two characters. In fact, they occupy more than half the verses devoted to named individuals. They are Abraham and Moses. And that is not accidental. They have been singled out by the writer for one very simple reason. He doesn't go for David or Elijah or any of the others. It's Abraham and it's Moses because in the whole Old Testament there are no other examples that can compare with these two men of those who deliberately turned their back on so much of this world because they happened to believe there was another one. And although it's not my subject this afternoon, there's one man who turned his back on a fabulous city, Ur of the Chaldees, because he'd seen another city which had foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And with all courtesy to Charles Dickens, the life of Abraham is effectively a tale of two cities. A man who turned his back on one because he saw and believed in another. But Abraham and Moses share in common this, that they turned their back on this world, because they believed in the reality and existence of another world. And Moses is particularly relevant to the case and situation and circumstances of these Hebrew Christians. What kind of faith does Abraham or Moses have? Well, at the beginning of the chapter, the writer has described the kind of faith he's interested in. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. It is the evidence of things not seen. Faith gives substance to things we hope. Faith gives reality to things we hope for. Faith makes real to us those things which lie in the future. Faith is the evidence. It is the proof to our hearts of that which we cannot see. And this faith operates in the life of Abraham and Moses as in the others. But Moses steps onto the stage in this passage I've read as perhaps the most telling example given the situation in which they were found. What did we read from chapter 10 and verse 33? That they had been made some kind of theatrical performance by way of reproaches and afflictions. And of Moses, he says in verse 25 of our chapter, he suffered affliction, and verse 26 tells us of how he endured reproach. They had lost so much of this world's goods. But Moses deliberately, consciously decided to part with and sacrifice this world and all it had to offer him at the time. They had suffered reproach. In chapter 13, he will tell them, "Let us go forth unto him without the camp, bearing his reproach." Who is he? He is Christ. And he will say of Moses, and we'll explain it when we get to it in verse 26, he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. They had deliberately chosen to throw in their lot with others who were imprisoned and despised and ridiculed. And Moses, for his part, had deliberately thrown in his lot with those that are labeled in this passage the people of God. That's why Moses is so important in Hebrews 11 to the case and circumstance of the readers. Now all that, in a sense, by way of background, as we'll now look at the verse in detail, verse 24, "By faith Moses, when he was come to years..." The preacher Stephen in Acts chapter 7 points out in verse 23 that when he was a full 40 years of age, Stephen is at pains in Acts 7 to break up the life of Moses for us into three compartments of 40 years each. We're indebted to him for that. It is Deuteronomy 34 verse 7 that tells us that Moses' innings was 120 years. But it's Stephen in Acts 7, verse 23, who tells us he was 40 when he left Egypt, and in verse 30, that he was another 40 years down the road when he left Midian. He was full 40 years of age. The way the writer to the Hebrews puts it is, "By faith Moses, when he became great," would be a literal translation, though it probably means this, "when he came to mature years." And the significance of that really lies in the last verse. "By faith Moses," but it was his parents' faith in verse 23 that accounted for him being hidden because he was a comely child. It was their faith which enabled them to overcome fear of the king's commandment. Now he has come to years. He is of mature years. He knows what he's doing. He knows why he is doing it. He is no longer a child. And what is it he does? He refused. He rejected something. He resisted something. This word translated refused here in the Authorized occurs 30 times in the New Testament, and on 28 occasions it's translated to deny. It's used of denying the Son of Man, for instance. And just as it is possible for a believer to disown the name of Jesus in one sense, to deny him as Peter did, so Moses disowned a title. He disowned the title Son of Pharaoh's Daughter. He, if you like, said no to the title Son of Pharaoh's Daughter. In doing that, he renounced all the status and position that that name or title carried. We read from Exodus chapter 2, we read these words, that he, Moses, became her son. In Acts chapter 7, Stephen said that she, that's Pharaoh's daughter, nourished or brought up or reared him as her own son. Brought up with that position and status as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. I can't be dogmatic. Personally, I believe that we're somewhere around 1486 BC. And if that is right, then this particular woman was no ordinary woman. She's an extremely famous and also a very exceptional woman. And a little later than this, she actually ruled Egypt behind the scenes for over 20 years, operating through a very young pharaoh. This woman, however, whether that was the one I'm thinking of or not, it was to her that Moses owed a tremendous amount. And I'd like you just to imagine with me the difficulty that faced Moses. This was not an easy decision. He could easily have rationalized his situation and defended staying where he was on the ground, first of all, that he was obligated to this woman. She had saved his life. Without her, he would have perished. She not only saved his life, she was also responsible for one of the most remarkable educations that any man has ever received. Stephen bears him witness that he was learned, skilled, trained, instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And Moses could marshal the art and the culture and the technology of Egypt, and he owed it all to her. Now is he to slap her face and to walk out of the palace? Is that the thanks that he owes the daughter of Pharaoh? And what does it mean to the providence of God? Can he deny that God had put him in this position? Like, what coincidences march through Exodus chapter 2, where he, in his ark of bulrushes, and then Cain, Pharaoh's daughter, it says, and she has compassion when she hears him cry, and she takes him to be her own son. It was a remarkable train of circumstances that had led him to the court of Pharaoh, the palace of Pharaoh. And even that had a nice twist of irony to it. In Exodus chapter 1, when this Pharaoh came to the throne, Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, he was concerned about the growth and multiplication of the children of Israel. So what did he do? He consulted. And he said, let's deal wisely, authorized version, let's deal cleverly and craftily with them, lest they escape out of our land. And it was that same Pharaoh who in the end provided board and lodging and education to the man who God was raising up to accomplish the very act that Pharaoh was determined to prevent. Moses has to weigh up these things and reflect upon his debt to Pharaoh's daughter and also to the workings of divine providence, and also, I suppose, to consider what service he could have been to his people, his brethren as he regarded them, if he'd stayed. He could have no doubt risen in the court of Pharaoh to exert considerable influence to better and improve the lot of his brethren in Goshen. All that is a possibility if he stays where he is. The writer to the Hebrews says, by faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He abandoned and turned his back on the dignity and the position and the prospects that were his in that situation. Verse 25 tells us that he chose What did he choose? He chose to suffer affliction. This isn't something that's thrust on him. This isn't something that happens, but he volunteers for it. It is a conscious and deliberate decision to throw in his lot with a downtrodden, despised slave population of Goshen. How do you think that read across to the Hebrews as they have this epistle read to them? Choosing to throw in his lot with a people like that, to suffer affliction. In verse 37 in the Authorized Version, we read about those who were tormented. It's the same word here, suffer affliction. In the beginning of chapter 13, we read about those who suffer adversity, verse 3. Same as here, suffer affliction. But the difference is that Moses chose it. And he chose to suffer affliction along with the people of God. Moses knew of his relationship to Israel, whether he got that from his mother in his very early days, or whether Pharaoh's daughter had shared the information with him, we don't know. I don't suppose we care very much. But here we have a man who is schooled not only in the art and technology and culture of Egypt, but in the promises made to the fathers. He regards that slave group as the people of God. In Exodus chapter 2, we read, he went out to his brethren, and he spied an Egyptian smiting one of his brethren. Stephen picked that up. Acts 7:23, it came into his heart to visit his brethren. He knew his relationship to them. Not, so you don't misunderstand what Stephen's saying, not that he was just going to pay a visit to them. When Moses went out to his brethren, it marked for him a complete withdrawal from the palace. He was renouncing forever his position in the court of Pharaoh. And it wasn't just nationalistic feelings. It wasn't just common race that took him. He saw them as the people of God. He didn't see them just as the children of Israel. Now, I know in verse 22 of our chapter, Joseph, he makes mention of the departing of the children of Israel. That's not how Moses saw them. To Moses, they were distinctively the people of God. He saw them in terms of the purpose of God. He has a choice to make. He is the son of Pharaoh's daughter by title, but he chooses and sees more honor in the title son of Abraham than ever he does in the title son of Pharaoh's daughter. And he chooses not to enjoy something, that's what it says here, but to endure something, to endure affliction rather than enjoy the pleasures of sin. And I suppose the court of Pharaoh offered virtually unlimited opportunities for pleasure. But to Moses, they were stamped as for a time, literally. For a time. They were transient, temporary, fleeting, passing pleasures. There was something that wasn't temporary. And that's where the Hebrew Christians, as they read this letter, must have got excited. They had taken with joy the spoiling of their goods because they knew they had in heaven a better and a lasting set of possessions. There was something eternal. There was something beyond this present life. They knew that, and now they discover that Moses knew that as well. He looked at the pleasures of Egypt as something which were transient here today and gone tomorrow. Verse 26, he esteemed the reproach of Christ. He esteemed. He considered it. It's very difficult, actually, to translate this word. It doesn't have anything to do with an inner feeling or sentiment. It is rather the weighing up of known facts. It is the reaching a careful, deliberate judgment in the light of known facts. Here is a man who weighs up the issues carefully in his mind. That's what the writer is saying. And I want you to imagine with me, just to watch Moses as he examines and considers the options that lie before him. He has two, effectively, and I want you to imagine these scales, these balances, and how Moses will place one thing on the one and something on the other. On the one side, there are his links with Pharaoh's daughter. On the other, his links with the people of God. And he makes his decision, which to many people is strange and unaccountable. But I'll explain in a moment. It was the only sane decision to make. But he makes his decision, which is to prefer hardship to comfort, reproach to honor, affliction to pleasure, the slave camp of Goshen to the palace of Pharaoh, shame to fame. These are the decisions that Moses makes. Now, it must have seemed an act of sheer and utter folly. Who in his right mind would have chosen what Moses chose? I would suggest anybody in their right mind would have chosen what Moses chose if they happened to believe what Moses did. Moses was no fool. We know that at least, that he was skilled in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. The man is no idiot. He's been brought up in the highest education the 18th dynasty can offer. What the man did was simply weigh up the issues of this life, the issues of time, in the balances of another world, in the balances, if you like, of eternity. And he made a perfectly normal, sane, rational decision. He went for the most valuable. Who wouldn't? He chose what was best for him. He chose what would give him the most. His decision was perfectly ordinary. What wasn't ordinary were the considerations that swayed him. We'll come to those in a second. He esteemed the reproach of Christ, the same kind of reproach that Messiah himself will experience when he was here. He considered that far greater riches than the fabulous treasures of Egypt. He doesn't complain about reproach, he prized it. Why? What was it that moved Moses? What was it that influenced Moses to regard life in this way? The writer's told you. He's given you the insight into that motive and spring of Moses' actions. It was by faith. The kind of faith that operated in his parents. The faith which makes real to you what lies in the future and is the proof to you of what you cannot see. You'll notice that in verse 27, he endured a seeing him who cannot be seen. He had respect to something. He had respect. All the other verbs that we've been looking at today, they all indicate a crisis, something that Moses did once and for all, a single action. But this one is different. He refused one moment. He made that decision. He esteemed. He made that decision at a crisis. But he went on having respect for. He continued to have respect for something. And this word translated respect, if you do it literally, it means to look away from. And what you're being told is that Moses shut his eyes to so much and fixed his attention on one thing. It's the word that the Greeks would have used outside the Bible for a vain woman who would admire her reflection in a glass, or an artist who would be totally absorbed with the object or the model as he is trying to capture and reproduce it, either sculpture or painting or whatever. And that's the word the writer uses here. Moses turned away from other things and riveted his attention on the recompense, the payment of the wages, if you like. Now that's back in chapter 10, isn't it? You cast not away your confidence, which hath great recompense of reward. Moses is the classic example to people in their situation. He looked beyond this world to another. I quoted before from chapter 6 that God is not unrighteous to forget our work. I love to think that in chapter 10 of this same letter, verse 17, he will tell us that their sins and iniquities I will remember no more. To remind myself that I serve that kind of God who does not remember my sins but does not forget my service. And Moses believed that. Moses believed that he wouldn't be the loser. He believed that there was such a thing as payment of wages in another world. And what other people shunned, he prized. And what other people coveted, he renounced. All the status, the advantages, the position, all the pomp, the splendor and glory of Egypt, when it really was at its finest hour as far as previous history had gone. All the luxury, the ease and the pleasure, the prospects, the bright prospects. Who could say where Moses might not have risen if he had stayed? But he renounced all these things because it made sense to do so. Because looking at things as Moses did and seeing what Moses saw, it was the only sensible, rational thing to do. Because he really believed something. He really believed that Israel were the special, chosen people of God. Poised to be delivered at any moment, as he saw it, by the power of God. He looked at Egypt and he saw Egypt by faith, not as the world's greatest empire, but a people about to be judged by God. Had not God said to Abraham, 400 years shall they afflict this people, and then I will judge them. And the hour is rapidly approaching when God was going to judge Egypt. And his faith, he really believed that Israel was that, and Egypt was that, and he really believed this world wasn't everything, and there was another world where he would be more than adequately rewarded, and by faith he made his decision. It's faith, if I can change writers for a moment, it's faith, the Apostle John says, that overcomes the world. What is the victory that overcomes the world?